We are going to spend a little time and do our best to get our arms around the mutual fund industry. It is not an easy job. Standing in front of you is an 800-pound marshmallow, and you're going to somehow try to take that 800-pound marshmallow and gather it up in your arms. Not an easy thing to do. And what we would do in the face-to-face class is build a large array of items on the board in front of the students, and then I would refer to it as we were discussing mutual funds and going back and forth between the different types. So it's kind of hard to do, so I created this scramble sheet. You can print it out or have it up on your screen. I'm going to bounce back and forth between the two. I'm not sure if it's going to work, but we'll see. Because we're going to start from the riskiest mutual funds to the least riskiest. And what we're going to find is that risk is not easy to measure. It's very difficult. In fact, it's impossible. There are measures of risk that the industry uses, but none of them are perfect. What they mostly key on is the volatility. The volatility, the fact that this investment, although it's done very well over a certain amount of time, it has a tendency to lose a great amount of the principal from time to time when the market crashes, right? And so let's start with the riskiest funds, and those are stock mutual funds. And then we're going to see that within stock mutual funds, just as we saw within stocks, there are various levels of risk. So here I have the items listed from the most riskiest to the least riskiest. And I do the same on the scramble sheet. Here's the mutual fund scramble sheet. But we're going to see that there's a few things I did on the scramble sheet that really don't translate well to the presentation. So we'll bounce back and forth. All right? So here's the most riskiest, the aggressive growth funds. They also go by various names, Momentum, Ultra, which are meant to denote that they're even riskier than many aggressive growth funds. And what are these folks doing? They are rolling the dice, folks. They are trying to achieve eye-popping returns, normally by buying and selling and buying and selling stocks, often the most growth-oriented stocks, the ones that are on the cover of Gentleman's Quarterly and Vanity Fair and People Magazine, the celebrities. And you know what? Some of them do very well for their investors, but some of them fall into the dark place where they can lose 50, 60, 70% in a serious market downturn. So now, I have a little thing I use. I didn't write it down here. I thought I did. I apologize. I have to go back and check. Or if I haven't, I want to do that. I call these the spice. Here's the spice, folks. The aggressive growth funds. I think of a buffet. And I think, you know, these aggressive growth funds, they're like the hot chili peppers, the jalapenos, the Thai food or the Indian food, which scorches your mouth and makes your eyes water and your forehead break out in sweat. When you go to a buffet, do you fill up your plate with these types of foods? No, not at all. And so the same thing should be true with your investment portfolio. If you are so inclined go ahead, take 5-10% of the money that you are allocating to your 401k or your Roth IRA and put it into an aggressive growth fund. I don't recommend it. I don't do it. I think it's not something for the vast majority of people. A few individuals who have a taste for risk really enjoy seeing the market fall. I don't know how many people that is. They're fine. But what I find is that people who really, you know, don't know anything about the market's history of stock investing, have not educated themselves, they sit down with their 401k brochure and they look for the mutual fund that has done the best over the last 3 years or whatever, or maybe just 1 year. And they see, wow, look at this thing. It did 50% last year or 30% last year. I'm going to invest everything in there. What do you think about? No, I don't think it's a good idea either. No. They're not ready. They're not anticipating that next year it could fall 30% or 40%. And so they rush in where fools rush in where wise men fear to tread, and they get burned. So that's my advice on those. The next category are the growth funds. And these funds invest primarily in companies that are growing their dividends. This is, again, some hot and spicy food, but it's not necessarily going to burn you as much as the aggressive growth funds. But it can. Depending on the growth fund, it can. And here's where it starts to get a little strange and twisted. Because lumped into the growth funds are the capital appreciation funds. Well, wait a minute, Payana, what's the difference between growth and capital appreciation? Don't they mean the same thing? Well, there are subtle differences between the two. A growth fund will have in the prospectus a line, some sentence somewhere saying that we will be primarily 80% or whatever invested in stocks that are growing their earnings, growth stocks. Whereas a capital appreciation fund is charged with the task of growing your money. Capital is a fancy word for money, appreciation, growth. And they don't have to invest in growth funds. They often are very flexible because they can invest in a cyclical company or a defensive company or a turnaround if they thought that the potential for growth of capital were there. Do you see the subtle difference? And you, dear students, are supposed to understand this. And do you think most people looking at their 401k plans understand? No. So in the scramble sheet, what I have done is I have wrapped capital appreciation funds around the growth funds and aggressive growth funds. Because I have seen growth funds that are extremely aggressive. And then I have seen capital appreciation funds that are extremely aggressive. And then I have seen capital appreciation funds that, you know, not so much. You know, they have a tendency to go after stocks wherever they may find them that have the potential to grow. So you really have to know the mutual fund you're looking at, as well as understand the different subtleties. Because one of the most bizarre situations in the industry is a very popular, one of my favorite funds, by the way, called the Growth Fund of America. And we use that in one of the illustrations for Chapter 12. It's a capital appreciation fund. Wait, and then it's called the Growth Fund of America. Well, the name, the Growth Fund of America, came long before the industry created these categories. So don't blame the Growth Fund of America for being a capital appreciation fund. You know, they shouldn't have to change their name because the industry around them created these categories. They were created long before the categories existed. You see what you're up against? Okay. Now, the next group is one of my favorite groups, and this is called growth and income. Let's see. We want the money to go up. We want the value of the company to go up, but we also want income from stocks. And what is income from stocks? Dividends. So we are blending growth companies and dividend companies. In fact, some people will call these blend funds. They'll also call them value funds. And so we try to show that on the scramble sheet by having value and blend. I don't know. If it helps, you know, I'm doing the best I can. All right, folks? But if if that helps you, great. If not, my apologies. And why do I call this my favorite? Because when you blend the growth and the dividend companies, you often find that they will be countercyclical. The growth stocks will zoom up, and the dividend-paying old stodgy stocks will they'll go up too, but nowhere near as much as the growth stocks. Then, when the economy is on hard times, the growth stocks will take it on the chin and fall precipitously, whereas the dividend-paying stocks, yes, they always have a positive in that. That dividends are always a positive. They don't take money away from you. And so they will hold up. In fact, sometimes, as we talked about with the defensive companies, they'll do better when the market tanks. So what can we call this category? I like to think of it as the entree, the meat and potatoes, the pasta. This is the main dish. This is what, as a stock investor, you should have the majority on your plate at the buffet. And this, personally, is where I often suggest that they start when they just start investing. Start them with a growth and income, and then after a few years, after there's been a downturn, you say, well, how did you do? We call them during the downturn. How did you do? Did you freak out when the market went down? And they'll say, yeah, oh my goodness, oh, yeah, I lost $40 or I lost $100. Oh, this is terrible. And, you need to move down the scale. You need to have something less risky, maybe a balance fund or an equity income fund, because, you know, you're losing sleep over your investments. If they say to me, I didn't even open up my statement, bingo! Okay, that's great. Yeah, good. Now we can think about adding some more spice to your portfolio. Does that make sense? I hope it does. If not, you know, contact me and we'll talk about it further. Because these are moderately risky. Don't get me wrong. But when the market drops precipitously, they're not going to lose 50, 60, 70%. They may lose 30 or, you know, 25, 30... at the worst, 40%, which doesn't sound like a big difference. But when you think about the numbers, folks, if you have $10,000, a 70% drop is down to $3,000. 60% is $4,000. A 30% drop is down to $7,000. Are you with me? You following? Yeah, how would you? It's not fun to lose money, folks. It's never fun to lose money. But it's going to happen if you invest in stocks. And so we want people to understand that you know, you're going to lose money, but if you stick with these folks, there should be a bottom somewhere that where your stomach won't go through the floor. The last category of stock in mutual funds are called equity income, which is just, you know, it's a silly name, folks. I know why it's called equity income, and people in the industry know why it's called equity income. Equity is another word for stocks, and income from stocks is dividends. So why don't they call them stock dividend funds? I don't know. I didn't make it up. But this category is great, especially as you age, as you get older, but knowing full well that people are living far longer in retirement, they want to protect against the downside, but they still need some growth, folks, because we're living in retirement 20, 30 years or more. So the equity income is a great category for them. And it's also a great category for people who have a hard time sleeping at night, worrying about whether the market's going to tank. Because when the market tanks, these guys will, they'll go down, don't get me wrong, but they'll go down 20, 15, 20%, where other people are going 40, 50%. Right. Why? Because they are the companies that we talked about when we talked about defensive and income-oriented companies, food companies, railroads, used to be banks. Banks are becoming boring again, but they're boring companies. Consumer staples, and people who make soap and toilet paper, things that you need every day. And so, I like to think of this in the buffet analogy. I like to think of this as the oatmeal. Right. Is oatmeal exciting? No. Is oatmeal good for you? Yes, oatmeal is very good for you. And look what it does for horses. It's excellent for horses. I mean, horses are magnificent, majestic animals, and they eat oats. Right. So these funds are great for people who are frightened and they still want to have some growth. And also as you age and are ready for less volatility, because you need less volatility as you get older. These classifications are just some of the major types, folks. They're just some of the major types of stock mutual funds. There are many, many more, but I want you to know these. I'm going to ask you. You're the expert, so we want you to know these. All right? Now, it gets even weirder, because what we're going to do is we're going to overlay two more categories. We're on slide number 10 now. We're going to overlay the size of the company. Remember market capitalization? And we're going to overlay the domesticity, which is a fancy way of saying where is the company based. All right? So two more categories we're going to add to the mix. So the capitalization of a company. Do you remember from our discussion in chapter 12, large cap, mid cap, small cap? Do you remember the papa bears, the mama bears, and the baby bears? Right, large companies, anything greater than how much? 10 billion, mid cap, 1 to 2 billion, up to about 10 billion of capitalization, and then anything lower than 1 or 2 billion. And so who do you think is the riskiest? Right, the small cap. Why? Because they don't have the resources to withstand market turmoil, to withstand economic turmoil. But they're also the greatest opportunity for growth, because there's small companies that have got a lot of room to grow. Large companies are less risky. Why? Because they have their roots deep in the economy and they can withstand the occasional recession and the like. However, exactly, they're not going to do as well over the long term just because they're already pretty large. And then we will look at the domesticity. Where is the company based? Now, here's a little bit of subtlety, folks, because domestic companies are very simple. They're based in the United States. Global mutual funds invest anywhere around the globe, including the United States, whereas international, you got it, right? Remember the world and the IFA? Exactly. International are mutual funds that invest in companies only based outside the United States. Now, this used to be neat and clean categories 40 years ago, but not anymore, Not anymore, because many domestic companies are global companies, and many companies based outside the United States do a large percentage of their business inside the United States. In fact, one company, Philip Morris, there might be many others, Philip Morris International it's called, it's based in the United States, but it doesn't sell any products in the United States. It sells all their products outside the United States. So it's all mixed up. But traditionally, the least riskiest were domestic funds that invested in domestic companies. The most riskiest were international, outside the United States, and in between was global. But that's not true anymore. It's just not true. The world is global for the most part, and everybody else except for a few gumballs are finding that this is the best system. Except for, you know, we said that. You remember the joke? This is the absolute worst economic system, except for all the others. Right. Okay, so what are we going to do with these two other categories? What we're going to do is we're going to overlay them on top of the first set of categories. We're going to pick one from column A and one from column B. So what you see is, oh, my goodness, it's a global large cap growth fund. Or, oh, it's a domestic small cap aggressive growth fund. And so now, do you start to see why we have over 11,000 funds? Because as these categories expanded and the companies tried to compete with one another, they would all come up with this new type funds, and if one company had it, then all the other companies had to have it. And so the mutual funds just exploded. My personal opinion is, I don't think it's the best idea. You know, I don't really think it's a great idea. However, you know, it's there, and and we have to deal with it. So it's on us to try to do our best to understand how the industry works. Personally, I try to keep things simpler and go with, you know, mostly global, mostly growth and income for individuals, but everyone's different. Everyone's different. Now, these other categories here really should have their own little slide, but I didn't want to create too many slides, so I stuck them in here because there was room. And what we're doing is further differentiating ourselves. Because some mutual fund companies have regional funds that just invest in Japan or Canada or China or the Far East or Latin America. I'm not a big fan of these because I like to think globally. I want to have my mutual fund manager invest where the best company is. I don't care where it's based. Whether it's in the United States, or in Europe, or in Israel, or Mexico, I want them to go find the best company. However, if you're, for example, working in Latin America, and you see that Latin America is booming, okay, fine, you might want to put 10, maybe 20% of your 401k contributions into a Latin American fund. But I really personally don't recommend it. It's your money. But the idea behind a mutual fund is to diversify, not to concentrate. Everyone's different. That's why there's chocolate and vanilla and some people like strawberry. But that's my humble opinion, and everyone's entitled to my humble opinion. It's a joke. Now, these next two are dumb. I call these dumb and dumber. Sector funds and market timing funds. Sector funds are funds that just invest in one sector of the economy. For example, energy, which is a huge sector, or technology. And then there are various sectors of technology. Some might invest just in wireless. Some invest in PC makers. Some invest in cell phone makers. Yeah. Healthcare, same thing. Some invest, some just drugs, some in hospitals, and not just that. Basic materials, lumber, leisure, all different. The consumer staples. There are all these different sector funds. Now, the reason I don't like these is because, again, our idea behind mutual funds was to diversify. But if you have some knowledge of the industry that you, because you happen to work in it, or for whatever reason, and you see that it's ready to do really, really well, okay, put a little bit, again, a little bit of spice on your plate, and go ahead 5, 10, 15%. But for the most part, you want to be broadly diversified. Now, market timing. Most people just don't even want to talk about market timing in polite company, and we really shouldn't, because it's no one has been able to do it well. There are people who tell you they've been able to do it, and they'll tell you they're going to do a better job next time because of the stupid things they did in the past. I think they are guilty of mostly fooling themselves, trying to believe that they know when the market's going to fall, they know when the market's going to, do well. There was a very famous investor from the mid-20th century, Bernard Baruch, who said, "Never try to time the market. It can only be done by liars." And I think he believed the same. I think these people believe that they actually can do it, and they can't. And they wind up screwing up, and so don't you follow them. Okay, now, let's turn our attention to bond funds. This is the category of funds that invests in bonds. But just as we saw with the stock world, we're going to go from the most riskiest to the least riskiest, knowing full well that in general, bond funds are far less risky than stock funds. Bond funds hold their own. Actually, usually when the stock market falls, not always, it doesn't always that work, the bond market does well. Why? Because we're in a recession and the stocks get hammered and interest rates go down because we're in a recession. And what happens when interest rates go down? Right, you remember that bonds go up. So they have a tendency to be counter-cyclical to the stocks. And we'll use that to our advantage. Hang on a minute. And so we find that the riskiest bond funds are junk bond funds, high-yield bond funds. Again, what do we know about a high-risk and high-return? Right, we can get burned, we can make a lot of money, but we can get burned. And so junk bond funds invest in junk bonds, bonds that are below triple B, non-investment grade, and they may do well. They may not. The next category are corporate bond funds that invest in BBB or above, AAA. Some, maybe they might take a little bit of BB or below, but mostly they're going to invest in the tried and true companies that will pay their debts. Yeah. And then the next category are municipal bond funds. Why? Because municipalities, even though they can go bankrupt, and they do, very rare, it's very rare, as opposed to corporate bonds, which, you know, corporations can go bankrupt, and they tend to go bankrupt at a higher rate than munis. And what did we say about the muni bonds? What were the very cool things about muni bonds? Right, tax-exempt income. And the same thing is true for municipal bond funds. Sounds like a test question? Yeah, exactly. Muni bond funds are loved by people in high tax brackets because that interest is tax exempt. And of course, if you buy a muni bond fund that's based in your state, in our case California, then you will not pay federal income taxes, and you will not pay state income taxes. Okay, got it? Right. So remember that, and that's often why, for the vast majority of us working grunts, these things they're not really that great for us, because we really don't need the tax advantage, but for people, once they get up into the higher tax brackets, that is very valuable to them. The next category are the U.S.-backed bonds. These are bonds that, while not explicitly backed by the United States, are implicitly, tacitly. There's a implied guarantee that the United States will come to the rescue if something goes wrong. you might have heard of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Ginnie Mae. These are private entities, or at least were, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that were sponsored by the United States Congress to help with the mortgage market so that there'd be plenty of money for people to borrow houses. And for decades, you know, everyone said, oh yeah, these things are basically safe because the federal government will save you. And the folks in the government said, no, 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 they are private entities. Yes, they were sponsored by the Congress, but if they go down, investors are going to have to go down with it. And sure enough, what happened in the Great Recession when Fannie and Freddie took it on the chin like everybody else did, as everyone else did? Right, the federal government swooped in, and now you and I, dear students, we taxpayers, are owners of Fannie and Freddie, which, you know, is not something we want to be forever. It was a good idea to not let the world crash and burn around us, but we got to get rid of these things. we got to spawn them off somehow. I don't know. The Congress has not been able to do much anything jointly. By the way, you're believe it or not, you're making money as a taxpayer. Fannie and Freddie are profitable again, and they're doing what they do best. They're helping spur mortgages for people to buy houses. So it's you know, nothing's perfect, folks. And then the granddaddy of them all, the least riskiest, are U.S. bonds. I'm sorry, backed by the full faith and credit of the United States Treasury. So if you want to sleep well, folks, this is where you put your money. But are you going to eat well? No, because they don't pay very much, and now they're paying almost nothing, which is better than some countries, which are actually charging you to have your money with them. They actually have negative interest rates, if you can believe that. Hard to believe, yeah. So we go from the riskiest bond funds to the least riskiest, and then, just as we did with the stock funds, we're going to overlay two more categories. Now, be careful. The domestic, global, international, well, that's pretty straightforward. It's the same idea. Global bonds all around the world, international outside, and domestic in the good old U.S. of A. But now, long-term, intermediate, and short-term. Which do you think is the riskiest here and the least riskiest? You might be tempted because L, long, large, S, short-term, small, and intermediate is kind of like mid-cap, right? You might be tempted to think of stocks and the large. No, it's totally different, folks. It turns out that the long-term are the riskiest here and the short-term are the least risky. Huh? Wait a minute. How's that? When you think about it, it actually makes a whole lot of sense. What's riskier, to lend somebody money for 30 years or 3 years? Right, exactly. The longer the time that the money is out there, the more chance for things to go wrong. So longer-term bond funds are more risky than shorter-term bond funds. In fact, short-term bond funds start to look like a money market. They become almost, you know, very, very safe. They'll go up and down just a tiny bit. Whereas long-term can go up and down a whole lot. But again, there's the more risk, the more opportunity for return. If we want to get more from our bond funds, the long-term bond funds are going to pay us better over the long term with the added risk of having them go down more from time to time. Is it making sense? So let's go back to our... See if we can move on over to the bond funds and see the same things. So here we are. We have the categories that we discussed. And what we do is we do the same thing. We pick one from column A, one from column B, and one from column C. And we have a domestic long-term corporate bond fund. You see? Yes. That's why there are 11,000 mutual funds out there, folks. 11,000, right. 11,600 or so. Okay, next slide. Balance funds. Now, these are funds that invest in both stocks and bonds. And some of them have been around for a very long time, folks. So it's an idea that's not new. they exhibit less risk than stock-only and bond-only funds. What? Shouldn't it make sense that they would be in the middle between, in terms of risk between stock and bonds? Well, as measured by standard deviation, which is an imperfect measurement at best, folks, it turns out that these things are less risky. Why? Well, it harkens back to what we said, that stocks and bonds often move in opposite directions. Not always, but often they do. So if we invest in stocks and bonds, when stocks are doing well, bonds might be just sitting there, blah, 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 right? But then stocks get hurt and go down precipitously, bonds will hold on to their value or maybe even go up. So for people who are really frightened but have a long-term horizon, younger folks, but they are really scared, I will do my best to get them to at least put their money here, because they should do a whole lot better than if they just put it into bonds or, heaven forbid, put it into the money market. Right, because they have a long-term time horizon. And if the world doesn't end, they're going to do a whole lot better with having a stock portfolio, however large, you know, even if it's only half. Now, here's where it gets really strange, because the asset allocation funds are lumped in with the balance funds, but they are very different, sometimes very, very different, and I'm not a big fan of these, personally. Doesn't mean you won't do well with one. But asset allocation funds often try to find the best allocation of your money. They say, oh, we think stocks are the best thing now. We don't like bonds right now, so we'll put everything into stocks and get out of bonds, or vice versa. Or we think all of them are bad, stocks and bonds, so we'll put everything into cash. This, to me, smacks of what is called market timing. And you know what we already said about market timing, don't you? Right, we don't like it. So I'm not a big fan of these. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't take a look at the options in your universe of choices. What I like are the balanced funds that market themselves as the complete investment program for the prudent investor. And I just love that line. That's the American Balance Fund, which has been around in one shape or form since 1937. Exactly. So some of these guys have been around a long time, and they've seen the good times and they've seen the bad times. For example, the American Balance Fund will never go above 75% stocks, 25% bonds, or below 50% stocks, 50% bonds. They will keep that balance. Yeah, okay. The last category, the safest category, are the mutual fund, the money market mutual funds. Money market mutual funds, folks, they look like a checking account. They're not guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. However, when the organic matter hits the ventilating device, and these things lose a penny, and that's exactly what they do. It's called breaking the buck. If you are so inclined, just type in to any search engine, breaking the buck, and you will see scads of articles about what happens when a money market mutual fund loses a penny. The whole world jumps up and takes notice, right? And the industry looks at them and says, "What did you guys do?" So the regulators come in, the industry comes in, because they don't want people to think that these things aren't safe, and they will literally take money out of their own pockets and put it into the pockets of the investors to make sure that they don't lose money. Now, this is normally never allowed. The first thing they tell you when you learn to become a broker or get into the investment world, you never commingle your money with your clients. But in this case, they have the blessing of the regulators, and the rest of the companies in the industry will help them if they don't have the money, because they don't want them to think that these things are not safe. There's over $3 trillion in these things, earning nothing at this point. In fact, in 2008, when two different money market mutual funds lost a penny, the Federal Reserve Bank, literally just said, look, don't worry, we'll backstop, and the Federal Reserve Bank, which has a checkbook which is infinite, folks. They can write as many checks as they want. They came in and swooped in and said, we'll make sure that these money market funds don't lose any money. And sure enough, that helped a lot in the, it wasn't the only thing that was going on in 2008, but that really helped the money market mutual funds. So we've gone, now forget the bottom part, we're not going to deal with that in a separate little line there, I didn't want to create an extra slide, but we've gone from the most riskiest to the least riskiest. And in the scramble sheet, that was the idea to show you the most riskiest to the least riskiest. And why do we do that? Because we need to understand risk versus return. And as we've already made, reference to, Joe Investor, when he sits down in that 401k meeting, he'll key on the most riskiest fund that has done really, really well. The last 3 years, the stock market's done well. And he'll put everything there. And then 3 months later, the market falls 30%, and you'll hear him say, ooh, is it too late to get out? And he'll take all his money, and he'll put it into the money market mutual fund because someone told him that he can't lose money there. And then, right, 2 years later, the market's gone up 50%, and he's asking people, ooh, is it too late to get in? And he takes all his money out of the money market mutual fund and moves it all the way into the aggressive growth fund just in time for them. And you think, you know, it sounds comical when I say it, but I see it over and over and over again. Why? Because as Warren Buffett says, investing is simple, but it ain't easy. Emotions, you have to deal with the intellectual part. Well, that's simple. When you understand the various categories and understand what can you reasonably expect it and what you're going to experience, you know you're going to experience it. It's never fun when you do, but you know it's going to happen. That part's simple. But when you actually do experience it, that part ain't easy. Right. So now, take a look at that scramble sheet. Try your best incorporate that into digest that, because that's what you're up against when you sit down with that 401k plan and they show you those 90 some odd options and you go, ah. In fact, in the 123 class, we spend time looking at sample 401k plans and we see one that I think is really excellent, and that's the Thrift Savings Plan through the federal government. And then you see one that I don't think is very excellent. It's gotten better, but our 403B through Southwestern Community College. All right, now this last category really shouldn't belong with the others because this is something that's set up for people to make life easier for them. These are called target date or life cycle funds or target retirement funds. They're really just mutual funds of mutual funds. And I should really take this little jab at them. Sure, buddy, I don't mind being charged twice. Well, it's tiny little charge because the mutual funds, they have their own charges, and then the mutual fund of mutual funds, they add another charge, but it's pennies, it's not very much at all, so nothing to worry about. And so what are they doing here? They know that people are confused, at best, overwhelmed with their decisions for their 401k plan and the like. So they've created these funds that you just say, okay, look, I'm going to retire in 2040 or 2030 or 2055. And you choose that fund. And what they do is they populate it with funds that are appropriate given, you know, in industry standards for those individuals. And as they get closer and closer to retirement, they move the mutual funds into more risk-averse, more secure, more conservative, not liberal versus conservative, not politics, folks, but conserve the money, more conservative investments. Does that make sense? Yeah, it does make sense. And these things have become very, very popular. Why? Because the Congress created what's called a safe harbor agreement. If you're an employer and you have an employer-sponsored plan, a 401k plan, let's say, and your student, not clients, you're not students, your employees start working there, you can put them in the age-appropriate target date fund, you know, whatever age they are. You look up the, oh, they're 23 years old, they belong in the 2060 fund, the 2055 fund. If you do that, automatically, you take 3% of their paycheck or whatever, they can always opt out. They can say, you know, I don't want that, I don't want that. Or they can add to it, or they can change the allocation. But if you choose that for them, according to the rules that are set out, then the employee cannot sue you. Huh? Why would the employee sue you? Well, whenever you take on the role of advising someone, recommending someone, advising someone about investments, you're opening yourself up for a lawsuit. If you recommend something that's totally inappropriate for that person, you can, and you, in my humble opinion, you should be sued if it turns out, as probably will. And this is when people advise really, really risky things for the elderly or people who are very risk averse or need the money soon. And it's, or, you know, yeah, we already talked, we already said nasty things about brokers, right? And so, yes, the employers were worried. Well, we don't want to put somebody into something that we might get sued for. The Congress said, no problem. If you do this, if you put them in the age-appropriate target date fund, then you don't have to worry about being sued. Cool? Okay. That's why those are popular. And you'll see those in your 401k plan. Slide 13. Specialty funds. These funds, for the most part, folks, I hope you'll stay away from. I know I sound very negative about many of these things, but there's a reason for that. Hedge funds. They were traditionally only open to sophisticated investors. What does that mean? That means people with a lot of money to lose. But now, people with not a whole lot of money to lose can get into these things. They're very risky, they have sky-high operating expenses, and they aren't even legally mutual funds. They don't need to do diversification. They can invest anywhere they want to. It's scary. Stay away. Bear funds are mutual funds that try to make money when the market goes down. That's not easy to do, folks, because first of all, the market goes up every 3 years up for every 1 year it goes down. You don't know which 3 years, you don't know which 1 year down, but that's the statistic you're up against. Precious metals and commodities we'll deal with in the next chapter. Well, it's not really a chapter, it's a in-between chapter, a lecture-only chapter. And the same thing is, stay away from those, unless you are really, really worried about the end of the world, and then we'll discuss that in the others, real estate and the other investment alternatives. And we'll also discuss these, which actually, of all the ones here, this is actually one that makes sense for some people. Not your whole portfolio, but what are REITs? Real Estate Investment Trusts. And we'll discuss these in detail in that real estate and the other investment alternatives presentation. But these things are mutual funds in and of themselves, but instead of investing in stocks and bonds, they invest in real estate. So if you want to be a landlord, but you don't want to fix a toilet, you don't want to fix a tenant, this is a great way to invest in real estate. They are the companies, well, they're not really companies, they're a little strange, they're trusts, so they're a legal entity other than a corporation, but they look like a corporation, they look like a stock as far as we investors are concerned, and they are the ones that own the shopping centers, and the warehouses, and the apartment buildings, and the office buildings, and they manage them, and just like a mutual fund, they forwarded on the rent payments and the capital gains, if there are any, when they sell property to you. So they're cool. And some people might want to have a little bit in REIT funds. But the problem is there's not that many REITs. There's just not that many of them. They're a sector. It's like a sector fund, really. So if you're so inclined, that's not a bad choice. But then what you'll find, if you do any kind of sleuthing about in the mutual fund industry, is that there are just hundreds of these exotic boutique funds, most of which are just ridiculous. I mean, the stock car stocks funds. What do you think they invest in? NASCAR. Yeah, I have a hard time believing this, But the biggest spectator sport in the United States of America is NASCAR. 200,000 people on a Sunday afternoon go watch cars go around the track at 200 miles an hour. Okay. And what do you see on the cars? Advertising. And the people who love NASCAR, they buy those products. If Folgers is the official coffee of NASCAR, they buy Folgers. It's that simple. So, have at it. The Paws Tombstone Fund. Paws is the name of the company. Tombstone was the name of the fund. What do you think they invest in? Not pizza. Mortuaries. Yes. Casket makers. Cemeteries. Why? Because, everybody's going to die someday. And thankfully, so did the Paws Tombstone Fund. And then, folks, you cannot make this up. Fiction is always second fiddle to fact. Somebody made up a fund called the Chicken Little Growth Fund for people who are worried that the sky is falling. There's the Timothy Fund for Christian good folk. There's a fund called the Vice Fund that invests in smoking and cigarettes and beer and alcohol. The choices are endless and so are the fees. So now let's get serious. Slide 14, index funds. Index funds have become extremely popular. How and why? Well, mostly Vanguard. They're not the only ones, but Vanguard is the company that has really pushed these to the fore. They have no management. Remember the people in the top hats? They're gone. The index fund simply buys all the stocks in a specific index. Remember the S&P 500, the U.S. total market, the EFA index. And so there's a list of 500 companies in the S&P 500. They buy them. You or I could run this fund. Because we look at the list of 500 companies. If it's on the list, you buy it. If it's not on the list, you don't buy it. It's that simple. Why? Well, because they don't have people in the top hats, they usually, but not always, be careful, have lower annual operating expenses. And many actively managed funds, many people in the top hats, don't beat their respective indices. In other words, they're out there buying and selling and deciding which companies to buy, and they don't do as well as a list of companies chosen by some folks in the offices of Standard & Poor's. So index funds became very popular because people said, well, I'm not going to pay those crooks on Wall Street. I'll just pay the Vanguard, everybody has them. Not everybody, but many people have them now. Fidelity and the like. And I'm just going to get me an index fund, and I'm not going to worry about having anybody make decisions. Well, the problem is they became victims of their own success. Not going to get into it, folks, but index funds, in my humble opinion, have a fatal flaw. They buy high and sell low. If a company becomes very popular. For example, a few years ago, Apple just exploded. And Apple's a great company. Don't get me wrong. It's a great long-term investment. But at that time, it just got way overvalued. And now there's a few other companies like that, Netflix and Amazon. People just say, look, no matter what the price of the stock is, you have to keep buying it. Well, what that does to the index fund has to buy more. Because as the company becomes worth more, it becomes a bigger part of the index, so the index fund has to buy it. They can't say, you know what, this is a great company, but this is too high a price. Let's sell some and wait for it to go down, or if it never goes down, well. The same thing happens on the way down. If the company is beaten up for whatever reason, their sector of the economy is hurt, but this company's doing okay. But it doesn't matter. Everybody's selling oil companies, or everybody's selling trucking companies, or wireless companies, whatever. As the company loses value, the index fund must sell. They cannot say, this is ridiculous. This is a great company. We want to buy more now. No, they are forced to sell. So, you see, I'm not a big fan of index funds because of that. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't be a big fan. You might say, well, Piano, you know, it doesn't happen too often. And I trust the index more than I trust the judgment of the mutual fund managers. And that's great. No problem. That's your decision. But I want to look for managers that have consistently beaten their indices over decades, not just for 1 or 2 years, or even 10 years is not enough. I want to see people who've done it for 50 years. And I showed some of them to you, didn't I? Right, and we'll see them again. There are companies out there. And if you hear somebody, an index fund fan investor, who say, oh, nobody can beat the index, you can't convince them because they're already convinced. They don't want to be confused with the facts. They'll never believe you, so it doesn't matter. You can't show them. You can't say, look, this company's done it, this company's done it, that company's done it, that company's done it. They just say, oh, they're just lucky. 60 years is lucky? Okay, whatever. Slide number 15. The buzz about ETFs. What are ETFs? Well, ETF stands for Exchange Traded Fund. And they started out as only index funds, but now they've become so popular, now there's some actively managed funds. So it's funny how they started out as index funds and now have gone back to that's passively managed, it's called, and they've gone back to the actively managed world. So what are these things? Well, they are index funds for the most part, but they are not bought and sold the way most funds are bought and sold. They are bought and sold on the exchange. That's why it's called exchange traded fund. So you need a brokerage firm, and you have to buy them through your broker. They have very low annual operating expenses, some even lower than index funds, but you incur the brokerage commission. Ha ha ha, some of the companies are very smart. Vanguard and Fidelity, they said, well, let's see. They created their own brokerage firms. And so if you open up a brokerage account with Vanguard or Fidelity, you can buy their exchange-traded funds and they will waive, W-A-I-V-E, they will waive the brokerage commission. Very smart, yeah, from a marketing standpoint. But as we said, be careful but just know what you're buying. There are now actively managed exchange-traded funds with people in the top hats who are, you know, deciding which companies are good to buy, which companies are not good to buy. And because they're exchange-traded, they can be bought and sold throughout the day, unlike all other mutual funds, which are just bought and sold one time a day. You know, mutual funds were not meant to be trading vehicles, but some people have turned them into trading vehicles. And I'm sure the folks at Vanguard and probably Fidelity too are just rolling around going, this is not what this thing was made to be. Oh, by the way, I keep calling Vanguard. Vanguard did not start ETF. They were one of the first to do index funds. They weren't the only ones. Some people say they were the only ones. No, there were other people doing it at the time. It was started in the 1970s. Why? Do you remember the theory, the one theory, the efficient market theorists? Exactly. They were adherents of the efficient market theorists who said that nobody can beat the market over the long term, even though there are people who do. That was started in the 70s. And then the ETFs were started in the early 90s, and I forget which company was the first to start it, but Vanguard has really, I keep mentioning them, but I don't own any stock in Vanguard, folks. I'm not trying to get you to buy Vanguard. Okay, so, but you will hear people who are huge adherents, huge fans of index funds and exchange-traded funds, and you will understand that no investment is perfect. There are advantages and there are disadvantages of every investment. So, whew, this is a killer, isn't it? It's only, what, seven slides, but it's a lot of information. So go back over and make sure you understand that spectrum, that full spectrum of risk versus return, from the riskiest stock funds through to the bond funds, to the balance funds, and then the money market funds. Okay? And in our last presentation on mutual funds, we will take a look at various mutual fund families and answer the question, so how do I pick a mutual fund, Piano? See you in our last presentation on mutual funds.